Culture Affidavit, episode 172. It's on Fox. Hello and welcome to episode 172 of Pop Culture Affidavit, the podcast that covers everything random in the world of popular culture, which is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. I'm your host, Tom Panarese. So 40 years ago this year, television got its first broadcast network in decades, the Fox Network. Since then, of course, there have been other broadcast networks that have come and gone. But Fox remains, and while still the younger of the big networks, is now an establishment as much as ABC, CBS, and NBC. But in its early years, it was anything but. Much like any upstart network, Fox tried all sorts of approaches. But most importantly, it targeted a younger audience way more than the other three networks. And I was of that younger audience at the time, so those early Fox Networks years were formative television years for me. That's what I'm going to talk about this episode, specifically the period of Fox that begins with its founding in 1986 and up until the beginning of the 1994-1995 television season. I'll explain the reason for that, but first I'm going to get into the history of the network and what led to its founding. Now, what's interesting about this is that I have told the history of Fox, or at least how it came to be, on two separate episodes. One was episode 108. That's where Amanda and I talked about Fox reality shows. Another one was the very first episode of my miniseries, It Came From Syndication. Fox is built on the corpse of two networks. The first network was the original fourth network. It was called the DuMont Network. DuMont went bankrupt in 1956 and spun off the two remaining television stations it had, WNEW in New York and WTTG in Washington, D.C., both of which, by the way, are Channel 5, into DuMont Broadcasting, which would later be purchased and renamed Metro Media. Metro Media would become one of the pioneers of syndication, as the DuMont name faded into history and relative obscurity. Much of DuMont's programming has been lost, having been recorded over or erased, which was a common practice in the early days of television. After all, reruns did not exist yet, and reusing old tapes was a good money-saving tactic. It's why certain old sitcoms have lost episodes, or other shows are almost completely lost except for maybe a few episodes or clips that were used in other shows. In fact, to this day, only a portion of DuMont's episodes exist. In 1985, Rupert Murdoch paid $255 million for a 50% stake in 20th Century Fox. Then he began buying up television stations, ultimately paying a total of $2.5 billion to acquire Metro Media from billionaire John Kluge. Between 1985 and 1986, Murdoch continued to buy stations, and ultimately he would buy up the remainder of 20th Century Fox. And then he announced the intention to create the Fox Network as a fourth network. And once the FCC cleared the way, that began to coalesce. WNEW in New York changed its call letters to WNYW in March of 1986, and Barry Diller, who had been the brains behind a failed effort to launch a Paramount network in the late 70s, and this is something that Star Trek fans are familiar with, especially those fans of Star Trek the Motion Picture, got the ball rolling. That's what leads us up to the beginning of our story here. This is October 9th, 1986. Fox has a soft launch that night with The Late Show, hosted by Joan Rivers. It doesn't last long. It's canceled before the network's official launch in April of 1987. This show, by the way, is what ends the relationship between Joan Rivers and Johnny Carson. Rivers had been a regular guest host on The Tonight Show and was possibly being groomed as Johnny's replacement. By taking the Fox gig, Carson felt betrayed and never talked to her again. In fact, she didn't appear onto The Tonight Show until 2014, when Jimmy Fallon had her on twice. The first time she was one of the many celebrities who paid Jimmy money in a "they all lost the bet" gag on his very first show. And then the second time she was on was just as a guest. River's story about this, especially about her relationship with Carson, the Fox show, and her husband's suicide, is definitely a topic for a different time. But I will, however, recommend the documentary Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. April 15th, 1987 is the official grand opening broadcast of the Fox network. The first two programs broadcast on the network are Married with Children and The Tracy Ullman Show, both of which would have an enormous impact and legacy with the Fox network in 1980s television. This was a Sunday night. Married with Children would stay on Sunday night for a while, as would Tracy Ullman. The following week and over the several following weeks, Fox would add new programming. The following week, Fox added 21 Jump Street and two sitcoms, one called Mr. President and the other one called Duet. They would then begin broadcasting on Saturdays that July with the pilot of the show Werewolf, as well as another round of sitcoms. The Savage Steve Holland helmed The New Adventures of Beans Baxter, the Patty Duke sitcom Karen's Song, which also starred a young Terry Hatcher, a sitcom version of the Nick Nolte film Down and Out in Beverly Hills, and the Matthew Perry starring show Second Chance. Second Chance would be retooled for its second season and would be named Boys Will Be Boys. I blogged about that show upon Perry's death in 2023. I will link to it in the show notes. In fact, a quick side note, four out of the six members of the main cast of Friends had roles on early Fox shows prior to that series' first episode. You know, Perry, like I said, was on Boys Will Be Boys, Second Chance, that show. He was also on an early episode of Beverly Hills 90210. Lisa Kudrow had a one-episode appearance on the sitcom Flying Blind. Jennifer Aniston was on the sketch comedy show The Edge and had like one or two other small appearances on sitcoms. And Matt LeBlanc had a recurring role in Married with Children. He played Kelly Bundy's boyfriend, Vinny. LeBlanc is also notable for because that character, Vinny, was part of two failed Married with Children spinoffs. One was called Vinny and Bobby, and the other one was called Top of the Heap. Back to the network. Fox adds a Monday night in 1989, and in 1993, it begins broadcasting on every night of the week, creating a true rivalry with the Big Three. The biggest difference in programming schedules at that point remains to this day, and that's that Fox's programming, for the most part, ends at 10 instead of 11. You know, ABC, CBS, and NBC break at 11 o'clock for the late local news, and then they go to whatever late-night programming they have, for instance, The Tonight Show on NBC. Fox does not have a news division. It has Fox News, the cable network, but it never established a network news division, and therefore decided that, I guess for whatever reason, the 10 o'clock news would stay for the local affiliates. I don't know what the reason for that was, but that's basically what it is, and local stations do still host their own morning, evening, and nightly news shows. 1989, by the way, is a hallmark year for Fox, not just because it added another night of programming, but because that year saw the launch of The Simpsons. This had begun as an animated sketch on The Tracy Ullman Show, and then with a Christmas special called Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire. Once this regular series launches, though, it becomes a massive hit right out of the box. It's the first primetime animated show to be successful since The Flintstones. The show was the first Fox series to rate in the top 30 of shows for a season and became so popular among a younger audience, there was a merchandising boom in the 1990s. Much of it featured Bart. If you don't remember, there were toys, there were t-shirts, there were posters, skateboards, lunchboxes, etc. There was an album called The Simpsons Sing the Blues, which had two particular music videos and singles associated. One was Do the Bart Man, and the other one was Deep, Deep Trouble. By the way, this also led to other networks trying primetime animated series in the early 90s. You had Fish Police, Family Dog, and The Critic. The Critic had a modicum of success over at ABC. It actually ended up on Fox at one point. It had a crossover episode of The Simpsons, which is sort of infamous because Matt Groening and James Brooks got into a big fight over it, and Groening actually removed his name from the episode. I'm doing this off the top of my head, but I think that's what had happened. But what's interesting too is that those other shows came and went really, really quickly. In fact, their gravestones are part of an opening gag of an early Treehouse of Horror episode. But that's pretty much what I'm going to all I'm going to really talk about with regard to The Simpsons. It really is a topic for another episode because it's just too big to cover here. I will say that the show's success showed two things. First, it showed that Fox had a place in the pop culture mainstream. Second, it showed that the network could compete with the other three, and not just because The Simpsons was a rating success. But for its first three seasons, the show aired Thursday nights at 8 o'clock. This was directly against The Cosby Show. And that started in 1990-1991, which was also a year that Beverly Hills 90210 aired on Thursday nights. That was another show that became a huge Fox hit, of course, despite being up against the Thursday night lineup. We're talking must-see TV. 1990-1991, that NBC Thursday night lineup had three of the top five most watched shows of the season. Cheers, The Cosby Show, and A Different World. Fox's thing for quite a while, especially in the early days, was attitude. This was part of an appeal to both youth and non-white audiences, especially African-American audiences. The big three networks were well-established and had identities. CBS, then and now, was pretty much the network for old white people, which I know is a pithy comment, but come on. ABC had a lot of well-known family-forward programming. NBC was where you could go for slightly more adult sitcoms and dramas. Of course, it's a Venn diagram. You know, for everything I say there, there was something that was a little more sophisticated on one of the other networks. But for the most part, the big three tended to be very middle of the road in a number of ways and also very, very white. They might get Black, Latino, or other viewers and occasionally had shows that appealed to young people, but they were always pretty safe. You know, they've all been around since the radio days. Fox saw an opening and went for it. I said that Fox began seven nights a week of broadcasting in 1993. I consider this the beginning of the end of the second Fox era. The first Fox era is from 86/87 when it was launched to September of 1990, which is when the network expanded to five nights and added a number of shows to its lineup that would last more than just maybe a season and would expand the network's popularity. That second era ends in the fall of 1994, and that's when Fox begins showing the NFL. That was a massive deal. Prior to this, CBS had the NFC, NBC had the AFC, ABC had Monday Night Football, and it had been that way for a very long time. Fox bid for NFC coverage and outbid CBS, and starting in 1994, they were broadcasting the NFC. The AFC was still on NBC. ABC still had Monday Night Football. And then I think CBS would take the AFC from NBC in 98. And NBC would eventually get Sunday Night Football. It has shuffled around networks, but for the most part, Fox has been the home of NFC football since 1994. And what that did was solidify Fox as the fourth network. I do remember some of the very, very early cop shows. Amanda and I did talk about Cops and America's Most Wanted on a reality episode. Werewolf, which was one of the earliest Fox science fiction / horror dramas, was one I did watch when I got the chance. This show starred John J. York as Eric Cord, who kills his college roommate Ted after Ted hands him a gun loaded with silver bullets and confessing he's a werewolf. Eric asks Ted for proof of this and waits for Ted to transform. Then he kills him, but not before Ted bites him, so he turns Eric into a werewolf. Eric's accused of Ted's murder. He goes on the run, and he begins to search for the head werewolf, whose death supposedly can break the curse he has. It's very The Fugitive and The Incredible Hulk, but you know, I remember it for being a solid show, and it fits right in with the other sci-fi and horror shows of the mid to late 1980s. Many of which I watched here and there, but I was about 10 years old at the time. Many of which were in syndication. You had the War of the Worlds series, the Twilight Zone reboot in 1985, which was on CBS and had some really good episodes here and there. Tales from the Dark Side, Freddy's Nightmares, Friday the 13th, the series, and so on. Another notable show from the first Fox era is, of course, one that was mentioned, the Tracy Ullman Show. I never really watched it first run. I caught a few reruns on cable networks back in the day, probably like Comedy Central and such. And there was also It's Gary Shandling Show. I have to admit, I never watched it. I do remember the commercials because they were very like Gary breaking the fourth wall in a number of ways and awkwardly talking to the audience or other people, trying to get them to watch the show. In one of them, I remember that he's like, I've got to clean the place up because the show is premiering, and he starts vacuuming, and they put that effect on the screen where the vacuum messes up the television signal, and he's like, oh, wait, and he turns the vacuum off. Now, it's a really dated reference, especially for anybody who already had cable back in the mid-80s, because that didn't do that. But if you had a broadcast antenna, like my parents did, it was the one that you had, it was on the roof of the house. If you you turned the vacuum on in the room, it actually did mess with the television signal. So ask your parents, kids. The theme song to Gary Shandling's show was actually pretty memorable too. In fact, I used to have this book of piano music for TV songs. In fact, I've got like a whole photo gallery on my phone of them because I want to do a blog post on those. So I'll get to those at some point. But anyway, I think it was like the 1988 or so edition of this. And that theme song was in it. So here's the Gary Shandling Show theme song.
This is the theme to Gary Show. The theme to Gary Show. Gary called me up and asked if I would write his theme song. I'm almost halfway finished. How do you like it so far? How do you like the theme to Gary Show? This is the theme to Gary Show, the opening theme to Gary Show. This is the music that you hear as you watch the credits. We're almost to the part of where I start to whistle. Then we'll watch It's Gary Shandling Show. This was the theme to Gary Shandling Show.
Early on, Fox also ran Family Double Dare on Sundays. That was part of an early strategy they had of rebroadcasting quote-unquote cool cable shows and specials, and there's more on that later. There were also attempts at news magazines such as Beyond Tomorrow. This was an import from Australia that focused on new technology and gadgets. Think Popular Mechanics or Popular Science, but as a TV show. Other shows included a short-lived television series version of The Outsiders that was based on S.E. Hinton's novel. I really did not even know this show existed back then. It aired in the spring and the summer of 1990. That was about a year before I actually read the novel in my eighth grade English class. I suppose I would have watched it had I already read the book, or had I seen a commercial, or maybe my English teacher would have pointed it out, but it went completely by me. It really didn't last very long either. But the show has early career appearances by Billy Bob Thornton, David Arquette, and Leonardo DiCaprio. Kim Walker, aka Heather Chandler, plays Cherry the Lance. We have another TV adaptation of a film that had a modicum of success, Alien Nation. The film was released in 1988. It starred Mandy Patinkin and James Caan. It was set in a future Los Angeles where aliens have come to Earth and integrated themselves into society. Caan played a human police detective partnered up with Patinkin's alien cop. Khan's character has a lot of prejudice toward Patinkin's newcomer. That was the name they gave to the aliens. But they have to work together to take on the underworld. So it's kind of like standard cop movie, like mismatched partners, but with the sci-fi twist. Kenneth Johnson, by the way, he had a lot of TV experience, but most, I guess, germane to Alien Nation. He helmed V. And if you want a really good rundown on V, go check out Shag's podcast, Once Upon a Geek. He does a great retrospective of V. You know, the original miniseries, the final battle, the TV series, merchandising tie-ins, the books, audiobooks and things like that. It's really, really great. I highly recommend going over there. So Johnson to helm the series. I thought it ran way longer than just one season of 22 episodes, but that might be because he directed four TV movies between 1994 and 1997. So maybe that's where like, oh, it was on longer than I thought that it was on longer than it actually was because of the TV movies. But I remember, like, I watched a few episodes of the original series. I watched at least a couple of the movies, or at least one of them, I remember. And it was solid. I might actually track it down for a rewatch because it's been 30-something years since I watched any of it. But it's also a great example of Fox trying to give people twists on typical television shows. So like I said, at its core, Alien Nation is a mismatched partner cop show, which have been around for, like, forever. I mean, cop shows in general have been a staple of TV since the very early days. Dragnet, for instance. So Fox was bound to have one. They just decided to give it that science fiction twist. And by this point, sci-fi was this second-class genre on television. It had a small boom in the late 70s and early 80s, mostly because of movies like Star Wars. But by the mid to late 80s, most of the network programming was like primetime soaps and dramas or family sitcoms. One last show from the first Fox era that I don't remember, but does need at least a quick mention, is Glory Days. Somebody liked the Springsteen song, I guess. That's a drama about four high school friends going their separate ways, according to IMDb. It starred Brad Pitt. He was also a number of actors who had early career appearances on 21 Jump Street. That show, by the way, speaking of cop shows, I've mentioned it a few times. It is actually one of my all-time favorite television shows. The Undercover Cops in High School show, it was an early Fox hit. Johnny Depp, of course, was its breakout star. It had a kick-ass theme song. But I'm not going to get into it too much in this episode for the same reason I was brushing over The Simpsons earlier. I think it deserves its own episode. After all, I do own all 5 seasons on DVD, and maybe once I complete a watch through, I will get everything together for an episode or two. So that does bring us to the 1990-1991 season. So the first Fox era starts with that Joan Rivers show and ends in the summer of 1990, because in 1990, in the fall, Fox expanded the nights it was broadcasting and therefore expanded its lineup. It had a lot more to offer. And I call that the second era of Fox. And here I'm going to talk about what I did watch and what I did like from that era. But first, I should mention that Fox actually made this season a big deal through a promotional music video that they broadcast during the summer of 1990. I think I remember seeing it on a broadcast of, like, Revenge of the Nerds 2 or something. In fact, I think I had it on, like, a videotape because it played, like, during a commercial break or something during the movie. Anyway. The promo is called It's on Fox.
Okay, who's the bonehead who broke the film?
Ta-da! Let's take a journey to the distant past in the Bart Simpson time machine.
What?
Back when hideous dinosaurs roamed the earth and out of the primordial sludge oozed Homer sapien.
Bart.
Notice the large stomach.
Bart.
Notice the extremely small cranium.
Bart!
Uh-oh, roll it, dude!
Get your butt over here right now!
Go!
put the video in the show notes. As you'll see, it's a callback to those old network promos from the 70s and 80s. I think it was one called like ABC is the Place to Be or something. It looked like some sort of like weird old Hollywood musical. I'm picturing a lot of celebrities on stairs for some reason. This, though, appealed to the MTV youths, you know? It's a cheesy video. The song, kind of an earworm back in the day. Still, it kind of got stuck in my head as I was prepping this episode. So they were at least successful in some way with the promo. And affiliates, by the way, had their own versions of the promo. I remember the WNYW one was called It's on Fox 5 for You.
It's on Fox 5 for you.
I looked at the Wikipedia pages of TV listings from the fall of 1990 until the summer of 1994. I watched a lot of the Fox network. By the end of that era, I had begun to watch less and less television overall, but was mostly watching NBC. This, after all, was peak Seinfeld. But I counted 30 shows that I either watched on the regular or at least sampled, and I've chosen 10 of them that I remember and will go a little bit more in depth with. But first, the others on that list. For reality, there was Totally Hidden Video, the Candid Camera ripoff that Amanda and I talked about in our episode. There was Yearbook, the high school reality documentary show that I blogged about back in 2015. Sightings. This was a UFO series that was pretty much like designed to compete with Unsolved Mysteries. What's notable is that that was a precursor to all those like alien autopsy specials hosted by Jonathan Frakes in the late 90s and early 2000s. Sitcoms. Oh man, how many times did Fox take a swipe at various sitcoms? Now, of course, sitcoms were like the predominant television moneymaker in the 80s and 90s. So with Fox, starting in 1990, you had Rachel Gunn RN. Not a show I watched, but I did remember the title. Whoops. This was a very dumb show where, like, the bomb had accidentally gone off and the only people left were the people in the cast. Shaky Ground. This was a Matt Furr-led sitcom that also starred Love Hewitt, or as everyone would come to know her in the late 90s and 2000s, Jennifer Love Hewitt. Down the Shore was a comedy about people vacationing at the Jersey Shore. Flying Blind, I mentioned that earlier because Lisa Kudrow was in an episode. This was a sitcom that starred Corey Parker from How I Got Into College and Taya Leone. And I want to say this is like one of the first times, it was the first time I ever saw Taya Leone in anything. The premise, from what I remember, was that like they hooked up and they were going to try to make a relationship out of it, but he's like this dorky guy and she's like way out of his league. You had Get a Life. A lot of people do remember this fondly. I have to admit, I hated it from the jump. I watched one episode, and it actually began my long-standing dislike for Chris Elliott. True Colors was an interracial Brady Bunch type of show. Rock, this starred Charles S. Dutton. He was a working-class dad in Baltimore. This ran for a few seasons. I remember it as being one of the better-written sitcoms of that Fox era. They did a number of live episodes during their run. And I guess with the two with the longest legacy from this time were, of course, Married with Children. I covered that a few Christmases ago for one of their Christmas episodes. Maybe one day I'll talk a little bit more about it in length because I did watch the show a lot, especially in reruns. And then you have Martin and Living Single. I never warmed to Martin. I just don't like Martin Lawrence. I watched some of Living Single when it was in first run. I caught a lot more episodes when it was being rerun in syndication. That was a really good show, and I think it's underrated. It premiered before Friends, but it had a very similar premise. Friends kind of ran away with everything. So, but I would recommend checking out Living Single. So sitcoms, like I said, they were the predominant, you know, format for popularity and in the 80s and 90s, especially during those like early hours of primetime. 10 o'clock, or in Fox's case, sometimes 9 o'clock, would be the drama hours. And over on the regular networks, you had Dallas, you had Dynasty, you had 30-something at that point. China Beach was on for a while on ABC. You had LA Law, of course. Hill Street Blues was in the early 80s. He had a number of different shows. On Fox, you had 21 Jump Street. It was one of its, you know, few dramas in those first few years. It was not on Fox anymore in 1990. The last season shifted over to syndication. But when you get to the early 90s, Aaron Spelling comes calling. You get 90210, of course, and I'll get to that later. But you also get Melrose Place. And I watched Melrose Place like on and off during its run. The show is like amazingly batshit crazy. And I think there was a point sometime in the mid-90s where they were just like, let's just let the wheels come off and see where this goes. I mean, you have the most iconic moment of the show being where Marsha Cross as Kimberly like whips off the wig and there's the scar and the if you watch Melrose, you know what I'm talking about. Another drama was The Heights. This was a show about a band. The theme song hit number one. It was called How Do You Talk to an Angel, if you remember that. What's funny is that it hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100 just that the show was getting canceled. So the theme song really didn't help with the show. There was Class of 96. This was a college drama that I remember watching the pilot episode of it, and I recall had Jason Gedrick from Iron Eagle. That's on YouTube. I might check it out. And there are more. Those are the ones I at least watched some of. And then there are a couple other shows I really couldn't categorize. I guess The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. is technically a comedy. It was like a Western satire comedy starring Bruce Campbell. It was funny from what I remember. I really didn't watch it very much. I'm not a huge Western person, and it might have been on against something else that I was watching at the time. I know it's kind of a cult hit, though. And the other one that started running in prime time around the time it was running during the day was Batman the Animated Series, which I think ran for like maybe a month or two, and then it just was basically on Fox Kids daytime. But that was a pretty big deal too, because like, again, aside from The Simpsons, what other time did you have a animated series in prime time? And I think it was on Sunday nights at 7. And Batman the Animated Series is like, to me anyway, the show against which all other superhero cartoons are judged. It's a pretty high bar to clear. So that brings us to 10 different shows that I either watched or remember very well. And I'm going to go a little bit more in depth with them. I'm going to start with the drama and then go by genre from there. And I'll start that right after this. So stick around.
Afternoon, everybody.
Ryan!
How's that baby treating you, Mr. Daly?
Like Thanos snapping his fingers at my bank account.
In that case, how about a beer on the house?
Sure, gotta give my mouth something to do between podcasts.
Say, Ryan, I don't get how you have so much time for podcasting. Doesn't your wife want you spending time with the baby?
Would you? Truth is, I think she's a little worried about how much time I'm spending with the kid, ever since his first words were Dagobah system. Now she wants me to go out and do something mature, something productive, and most of all, something lucrative that can support the family.
So you're going to...
podcast about Cheers, yeah. That kid's not going to start college for 18 years. I got time. Cheerscast, the podcast where everybody knows your name.
My short list of drama from a few minutes ago had two glaring omissions, and that's because they were, aside from 21 Jump Street, the two Fox dramas I watched and followed the most. They were also two of the most widely popular and, dare I say, iconic Fox dramas of the 90s. The first is The X-Files.
Thank you.
You don't need me to tell you how successful The X-Files was. It ran for 9 seasons until 2001. Then it had a 2-season revival in the mid-2010s. There were 2 feature films. If you're unfamiliar with the premise, the show is about 2 FBI agents who are investigating the titular X-Files, which are instances of the paranormal and supernatural. David Duchovny played Fox Mulder, the true believer. Gillian Anderson played Dana Scully, the skeptic. Again, mismatched cop show. And along with the Case of the Week episodes, there was a central conspiracy plot involved aliens, the government, and the mystery of what happened to Mulder's younger sister. When I say this show is successful, I mean like legit successful. It entered the pop culture zeitgeist very quickly. It averaged viewers at or above 10 million for its entire run. At its height, it was a top 20 show. It got 1 feature film while it was still on, and then somewhere down the line, the second one came out. And this, by the way, is despite starting out in what's come to be known as the Friday night death slot. By the time it switched from Fridays to Sundays, it was averaging between 11 and 15 million viewers a week, and that's seriously impressive. Why did it work? Well, the premise wasn't hard to get into, right? You had a cop show with mismatched partners, like I said, and there's spooky stuff. Despite what went on to become kind of a convoluted conspiracy, the premise was simple enough that people who didn't watch it on the regular could pick up an episode or two and not have much of a problem following it. Plus, Duchovny and Anderson were amazing on the show, which you need. A show like that is not going to work just on the spooky sci-fi stuff. You need good leads for it if you want to appeal to an audience beyond kind of that core geek audience. They gave great performances. They embodied the characters well. The two of them had great chemistry. And the writers took the material seriously because, you know, it's a geek show. It's science fiction. It's horror. And there have been geek-centered geek shows. It's not a derogatory term. I'm just trying to kind of place it in kind of our wheelhouse, I guess you could say. There have been shows where they take the material, whether it be superheroes or the paranormal or whatever, and low-key makes fun of it, lampoons it, or waters it down. But the writers, the stars, Chris Carter, they all seem to believe what they were doing or believe in what they were doing, and they stayed true to the genre and its fans, but also were able to appeal to the mainstream, meaning that they knew that they couldn't let the conspiracy drive the show. The characters had to. And Damon Lindelof did that with Lost years later, where the characters were way more important or way more interesting because the conspiracy and the backstory on Lost got very convoluted. But then there would be a number of shows that launched in the 90s and the 2000s that centered around a mystery and the writing and the characters were just not there for us to really care. Like, it's like networks were like, oh, people like the mystery. It's like, no, it's the actors and the characters. You know, it's people getting wrong because they're not paying enough attention. The X-Files, by the way, also premiered at exactly the right time. Science fiction and horror and syndication, it had been on the wane over the past few years. There weren't as many successful shows. Networks really didn't carry many of them. I think Sequest DSV had come and gone by that point or was on its way out. Lois and Clark was still going. The Flash had the one season. It really didn't take hold. Nothing really took hold the way The X-Files was, except for maybe Star Trek The Next Generation. And that was in its last, that like the last season of Star Trek The Next Generation, the first season of The X-Files, I think overlapped. So TNG was leaving a pretty big hole. Now, you had Deep Space Nine, obviously. You would get Voyager a couple of years later. But I don't know, people were hungry for something in that genre, and if you cross it over with the kind of spooky horror paranormal stuff of UFO conspiracies, you have a really great formula. And I think it sated a number of those fans. Now, the other drama, I've already mentioned it a couple of times, of course, it is Beverly Hills 90210. We'll be right back. I remember when this show premiered. I'm not sure that it got a lot of hype. I don't remember seeing commercials for it, but, you know, I was 13, so, you know, you can't really go by that. But it had a 2-hour pilot episode, and all I remember was that I stumbled upon it and watched most of it, I think. And didn't recognize anybody except Shannon Doherty, because Shannon Doherty had been on this NBC show called Our House. Deirdre Hall played the mom. This was right before she went back to Days of Our Lives and got possessed. And Wilford Brimley played like the grandpa. And they were like, Shannon Doherty was like the middle daughter. And I had like a total crush on her back then. Anyway, so I watched the show. And the next day I was in study hall. My friend Chris is like, did you watch that Beverly Hills High School show last night? And I think a couple of other people of us talked about it. None of us knew the title of the show. So we're just like, what was this? And, you know, I think, I don't know where the conversation, what the teacher probably told us to shut up. I mean, junior high for me, like the memories are either blocked out or fuzzy. So, but I do remember that exchange. Did you watch that Beverly Hills High School show? Funny enough, the show was originally called Class of Beverly Hills before they changed the title to Beverly Hills 90210. If you watch the It's on Fox video that I posted to the show notes, you can see where they have like some of the show titles up on the screen. Class of Beverly Hills is one of them. So 90210 in its first season had a bit of a slow rise. I want to say it wasn't until like the spring of 91, and that was toward the end of that first season, that it started to become a hit and really popular. And we're talking like Priestley and Luke Perry, Shannon Doherty, like in Teen Beat and all those magazines, and the whole running gag about how the fact that they were all in their 20s playing teenagers. I mean, Gabrielle Carteris was 30. But aside from that, it was like they had a show in that 18 to 49 demographic, like, or 18 to 24 demographic, even a little bit younger, like on their hands, that was a hit, and they knew that they had something. So what Fox did was actually pretty genius. Instead of waiting for September for the second season of 90210 to start, they did kind of like a season 1.5 and ran several summer episodes starting in July. Now, if you remember, this is like Brandon had been working at the Peach Pit, but took time off to work at the Beverly Hills Beach Club. And Brenda and Dylan, I think the first episode of the summer season was like, there was like a pregnancy scare between the two of them. So it got a little more soapy. But if you consider the fact that there's no counter programming in the summer, because with the exception of maybe sports, nothing is on except reruns, the audience, which was already there, grew, because it was like, we're making this for you. So they built up a lot of trust in their audience. I think they would run maybe one or two more summer seasons over the course of the high school years of 90210. And that helped. The second season rated significantly higher than the first season. It moved from Thursday nights at 9, where it was up against Cheers at the time. It moved over to Wednesday nights at 9. It would stay at Wednesday nights at 9 until the end of its run. It was always up against an assortment of programs, some of which were popular, some of which were like one and dones. And it got even more popular. Now, the show petered out in the late 90s. It became, because they all kind of got adult, and it became kind of like an attempt at being Melrose-y, but never really worked. And the last couple of seasons are kind of meh. I didn't watch a lot of the last few seasons of 90210, especially those mid seasons, until like it was rerun on like FX in the 2000s. And I know WPIX would rerun them in the 90s as well. So I watched a lot of the Brenda years there. But I was there for some of the bigger moments. Brenda telling Kelly and Dylan to go to hell. Donna Martin graduates. What's funny is that despite its being a pretty frivolous teen soap, it had a pretty big impact in its day, believe it or not. I mean, my generation still remembers it as one of the defining shows of the 90s. Spelling and series creator Darren Star knew what they were doing. I don't know how apocryphal this is. I believe that they had interest in adapting Degrassi Junior High, and that's what this grew out of. Remember that the 80s were also full of the John Hughes movies, which were very fairy tale in their ways. And Spelling had done Dynasty and a number of other shows like that. So if you kind of like mix all that up, you get 90210, which is rich kids with problems, some of which are like way out of the league of any middle-class suburban teenager who's watching the show. And it turned into a nighttime soap opera, especially when the show hit its stride. If you want a really good retrospective of the show, by the way, go seek out the 90210 coverage of the podcast Again With This. Sarah Bunting and Tara Ariano went through every episode over all 10 seasons. I think they stopped or finished their run with it like a number of years ago. So the whole thing is there. So let's move on to sitcoms. Again, Fox had a lot of sitcoms, and I'm grabbing two that had kind of like, let's give this the interesting concept type of show, because they tried a few of those during the 90s. One is obscure. At best, it's a trivia item. The other is an, oh, I remember that show type of show. It actually might be the inspiration for a Pixar franchise. The first sitcom is Great Scott. This sitcom aired in the fall of 1993. It aired only 6 of its 13 episodes. It was on Sunday nights at 7. It was up against 60 Minutes, which was the most watched show for that season, and it completely tanked in the ratings. In fact, I think it was like third to last in the ratings for the season. The premise was that we followed Scott Melrod, a high school freshman trying to navigate being a high school nobody, and then like we'd see his inner monologue and imagination play out as like bits between like scenes in the plot. It's kind of like very Dream On in a way. Scott was played by Tobey Maguire. I had not watched the show since it went off the air 34 years ago. And all I had remembered was Maguire, the imagination bits and the theme song. And the theme song was in my theme songs episodes a long time ago. I found one full episode on YouTube. It was episode 2, which was called Hair Scare. In this one, Scott gets attention from a very attractive, rebellious girl named Nikki, who is played by the actress Amy Brooks. But she's definitely made to look like Jennifer Connelly in career opportunities. Things go as they do in these situations, with Nikki getting Scott into lots of trouble, and hijinks ensue, especially one scene at the beauty parlor where Nikki supposedly works, and Scott runs into his mother, and yeah, it's all sorts of craziness. It's a show that was very, like, manufactured for the 90s kids. You have a theme song that I think was composed by Mark Mothersbaugh, and I only say that because he did a lot of music for the show. Anyway, I loved the theme song because it sounded like Jane's Addiction, and it wasn't until, like, years later where I finally found it again on YouTube that I realized it's a swipe of Been Caught Stealing, so that's why, to me, it sounded like Jane's Addiction. And the opening credits has a lot of, like, Trapper Keeper graphics, collage pieces, crazy fonts that look so much of what advertisers would throw at like tweens and teens in the early 90s. I'll link to it in the show notes and you can see it. It's very much like of the time. Great Scott was not a terrible show. In fact, the episode that I watched was pretty entertaining, even though I knew exactly where the plot was going. The concept of flashing to Scott's imagination made for some pretty funny bits, actually. I may say it was a little ahead of its time because you have shows like Scrubs that would come along in the 2000s and other shows, maybe Malcolm in the Middle a little bit. But it was also taking its lead from a couple of other shows of the era. My other sitcom for this category is Herman's Head.
This is Herman Brooks. Herman is just like the rest of us. Every day he has to make all kinds of decisions. Like what to wear, whom to date, and when to panic. Now, these decisions should be easy, but if you take a look inside Herman's head, you'll see why he sometimes has trouble making up his mind.
I'm Herman's intellect. Without me, he couldn't hold his job, pay his rent, or tie his shoes.
I'm Herman's sensitivity. Without me, he wouldn't feel tenderness, honesty, or love. The good things in life.
I'm Herman's anxiety, and I keep him out of trouble. And believe me, there's trouble everywhere.
I'm Herman's lust. Without me, he'd miss out on all the good stuff. You know, fun, food, babes.
Sometimes they agree. Usually they don't. But this struggle is going on inside all of us. And it's all going on inside Herman's head.
This ran for 3 seasons. It starred William Ragsdale. He was in Fright Night as Herman, a guy who works at an office job at a publishing house in New York. The show actually is just a typical office sitcom with sitcom characters and sitcom plots. The twist is that there are 4 other characters aside from Herman and his coworkers, but they're only in, well, Herman's head. If that sounds familiar, you're not wrong. It is the concept of Inside Out. I don't know if Herman's Head is one of those iconic 90s sitcoms or anything like that, but I would imagine that if you were to explain the show to someone who was around back then, they'd be like, oh yeah, I remember that. You can watch the entire show on YouTube. Somebody has uploaded all 3 seasons, although I will warn you that if you go to watch it, there's this buzzing from whatever VHS tape was being uploaded. It does get irritating. If you can tune it out, you know, you'll be able to watch it. At least the picture's pretty clear though. I watched 1 episode for the sake of the show that was called Fatal Distraction. It was an episode where Herman picks up a random woman in a bar, and she's played by Megan Mullally. They have a one-night stand, but it turns into a fatal attraction scenario. It's very middle-of-the-road sitcom-y, but the cuts to the various personalities act as the Greek chorus. That works pretty well and provides some decent laughs. They actually had some good chemistry inside Herman's head. I remember most of the show being like this. You kind of lump it in with every other sitcom from that time, but the concept works, or at least worked for a few years. It stuck with me for those 30-something years, to the point where when I did see the first trailer for Inside Out, I immediately thought of it. I was like, oh, that's Herman's head. What's also memorable from the show is that, at least from my perspective, a number of people on the show have appeared elsewhere or were recognizable elsewhere. I mentioned that William Ragsdale was the main character in Fright Night and its sequel. Jane Sibbett, who played the vapid Hetty, was Ross's ex-wife Carol on Friends. Jason Bernard, who played their grumpy boss Mr. Bracken, was seen in both V and V the Final Battle, and he's also in the Sandra Bullock movie While You Were Sleeping. Hank Azaria played Herman's best friend Jay. He's basically like the Larry from Three's Company character, you know, that lechy guy who's like the player. We go on to see him in like the Barney Stinson type on How I Met Your Mother. In fact, like Herman and Jay are very Ted and Barney. Azaria, of course, has been in a number of movies and also been on another show, which also starred one of the other members of Herman's Head, Yeardley Smith, who played the sweet one in The Office, Louise. They both are on The Simpsons. Azaria has been the voices of characters like Moe, Chief Wiggum, Apu, and a number of others. And of course, Yeardley Smith is the voice of Lisa Simpson. So I guess those are 2 of the kind of set categories. Dramas and comedies are like, that's what they are, to the point where like the Emmys separate them for awards. The other 2 categories I have like have programs that vary. They can be different things. One of them is specials, and the other one is like sketch comedy. My 2 shows for specials are a bit of a cheat because they, for the most part, were not original to or produced by Fox. First, there's movies. As Fox expanded its lineup, they started Fox Night at the Movies. Now, they did a few TV movies. I know there were like 2 sequels to Revenge of the Nerds. There was Revenge of the Nerds 3. And I want to say it was like a 4th one too. I remember the drama Doing Time on Maple Drive, which had David Strathairn and I think one or two people who has appeared in other shows, and Jim Carrey was in a dramatic role. It was the first time I'd seen him in a dramatic role. That is on YouTube, and again, maybe a topic for a blog post or something. But Fox aired feature films as well. Networks have been doing that for decades. ABC, I think, was like the leader of that because they would run Superman movies, Raiders of the Lost Ark. They ran the James Bond movies. So Fox basically was, we're going to pick up a bunch of feature films and run them. But a number of them were aimed at younger audiences. This is where I saw two of my favorite John Cusack movies, The Sure Thing and Say Anything, for the very first time. This is during a time where I was watching so many teen movies and really was looking for anything with Cusack in it because I'd seen Better Off Dead like a billion times, and the same with One Crazy Summer. So after watching each of these, I actually went out and rented them from the video store, and then I dubbed them to blank tapes so I could watch them as many times as I wanted. In fact, I want to say The Sure Thing and Say Anything were on the same tape, and How I Got Into College maybe was the third movie on that tape, or maybe Heathers. I might actually have it, but it's behind a lot of stuff in this basement, the cabinet with the VHS tapes in it. I'm too lazy to move all that stuff just to get it out. I have both of those movies on DVD now, by the way. The other show on my list for this particular category is the MTV Video Music Awards. Starting around 1990, Fox would show the VMAs about a week or so after MTV aired them. And now, because I didn't have cable until 1996, so back in the early 90s, I would watch, and I would sometimes tape that rebroadcast. Kind of gave me the ability to know what people were talking about when the VMAs were the hot topic in high school. I was still a dork who had no life, but still, at least I kind of could understand what was being said. Because the VMAs were like one of the events of the year. Everybody watched it because crazy stuff happened at the VMAs. There were awesome performances and people always watched music videos. Fox showed it. I remember watching it up until maybe about 94. And I do remember seeing that Fox did show Prince's performance of Get Off, you know, where he was wearing the assless pants, but they blurred the ass. So I got to see a lot of those iconic early 90s VMA moments. And I would actually watch the VMAs themselves until about maybe 2003 or 4. I'm not entirely sure. I was way too old for MTV by then anyway. And Amanda and I did talk about this on our most recent episode about VH1. She and I need to do an episode about the VMAs because we did watch them and we watched them together. And again, that particular part of our culture, the two of us can talk to from different perspectives. So I'm going to put a pin in that for a future episode. Now, finally, my last category here, variety and sketch comedy shows. And there are four of them. Two of them are stand-up comedy shows. One of them was a late night show they aired called Comic Strip Live. And the other one was a primetime Sunday show called The Sunday Comics, which spun out of Comic Strip Live because Comic Strip Live was proving popular. The two series were simply comedians doing sets. It was like Night at the Improv or the MTV Half Hour Comedy Hour or, you know, Stand Up Spotlight, like any of those shows you would see on other cable networks, because stand-up comedy was huge in the 80s and early 90s. One episode that I really remember well and had taped and watched over and over was of the Sunday Comics. It was hosted by Lenny Clark, and it featured sets by George Wallace, Kenny Rogerson, Susie Essman, and Tim Allen. For Tim Allen, it was right before Home Improvement premiered. Like, I think literally it premiered that following fall. And Allen did all the grunting, man humor bits that he became famous for. As teenagers, my sister and I found that hilarious. Wallace has said, I remember being funny too. I don't remember Rogerson's, but I do remember Essman's the most because she began with crowd work, and she sees this really good-looking guy. His name was Josh in the audience. She just looks at him. She says, "Oh, you strapping young buck, you," and then interacts with him and then just starts going on and on about being a Jewish woman from New York. And I remember one point she says she stopped dating a guy because he called her, pardon the slur, a Jap. And she says, "There are no princesses in the Esmond family. We're all queens." And then she talks about her family at one point and talks about gift giving. And the line I remember the most, she's like, "We don't cut back." And she yells that one of their relatives would scream, "Give her the receipt. She can return it," which reminded me of my aunt for some reason. So I still remember that line. And it's one of my all-time favorite stand-up comedy performances or bits, even though it was like maybe a tight 5 minutes on the Sunday Comics. And I haven't been able to find that, by the way. I looked for it so I could put at least a little bit of it in this episode. Could not find it on YouTube. Maybe one day I'll be able to track it down. Now, moving on from that and stand-up comedy into my last three shows, they're all sketch comedy shows. Two of them only aired for one season. It was the same season. The third one aired 4 or 5 seasons before it finally went off the air. The first one of the one season shows was The Edge. This was created by David Merkin. He produced Get a Life. He was also the executive producer of The Simpsons for a number of years. This is an ensemble show with a few notable cast members. Julie Brown, she was a comedian and singer of the novelty songs "'Cause I'm a Blonde" and "The Homecoming Queen's Got a Gun." I think she's also in Earth Girls Are Easy. Not to be confused, by the way, with MTV icon, the late, great Downtown Julie Brown. Also on the show was Wayne Knight, a.k.a. Newman. Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants, and then a then-unknown actress named Jennifer Aniston. The pilot episode is on YouTube. I checked it out because, like a number of these shows, I have not watched them since they were first on the air. The opening credits is definitely of the decade. It kind of reminds me of like the fake Real World credit show that Ben Stiller created for Winona Ryder in Reality Bites. The show opens with what would become a running gag throughout its run, which is that the cast is like collectively killed in some sort of accident while introducing it. In this case, the set collapsed on them. What followed is sketch after sketch, similar to what you'd see on, say, SNL or The State. There's no host or monologue. There are some interstitials, like short bits like "what blank is doing right this minute," or "people not connected to reality," or animations that I'm pretty sure were by Mike Judge. And I can see why the show was canceled so quickly, by the way. Yes, it covered things that were topical for the time, much like any other sketch show would. And while Aniston and Knight were funny, the most of the show wasn't. Julie Brown did a dumb Mariah Carey parody video. There was a sketch where Aniston and Brown played Axl Rose and Slash's ditzy girlfriends. There was a parody of Cops called Exterminators, a fake commercial for a Reebok pump sneaker that when you pump it turns into a high heel. And they called them Doomy Pumps. There was a Designing Women parody. The show is very meh. And you kind of check it out of curiosity. The other single season sketch show, which is one of my all-time favorites, by the way, is The Ben Stiller Show. Starring Ben Stiller, Gene Garofalo, Andy Dick, and Bob Odenkirk. It originated on MTV, and then Fox bought it and aired 12 new episodes. The Fox episodes were all original material. Some of the MTV sketches were available as bonus features when the show was released on DVD. I do own the DVD, by the way. The format was just several sketches for the half hour and interstitials where Ben hangs out with like in LA with like another cast member or a celebrity guest. Those guests were included Bobcat Goldthwait, James Doohan, Colin Quinn, Sarah Jessica Parker, Flea, Rob Morrow, Gary Shandling, and Dennis Miller. There were a number of guest appearances by people in sketches. Also of note was that the co-creator and executive producer of the show was Judd Apatow, and David Cross was one of the writers. I've rewatched the show a few times over the years. It's definitely of its time, just like, say, The Edge, but it holds up better, mainly because it's actually funny. I had a feeling that The Edge was trying to do a little too much SNL, where Stiller was leaning close to what you get from, say, like, The State. This premiered, I think, about a year or so after it, maybe around the same time. I can't remember exactly what year The State premiered. I know I was in high school, like the latter part of high school. The Ben Stiller Show also did not use a laugh track, and I think that helps the show tremendously. It won an Emmy for Outstanding Writing at a Variety or Music Program. Memorable sketches on The Ben Stiller Show include a running sitcom parody starring a titular sock puppet named Skank, one of which went after like the Dan Quayle Murphy Brown controversy by having Bob Odenkirk play the vice president and accuse Skank of encouraging kids to waste water. There are a few good movie trailer and commercial parodies. One of them parodies the then long-running Joe Von Musk for Men campaign called What Sexy Is. If you don't remember that, it was basically like hot people doing suggestive things while a jungle-esque drumbeat played. The very typical, like, you know, wear this cologne, you'll get some type of commercial. Stiller's commercial had him in a long-haired wig, a denim vest, swinging a sledgehammer. Andy Dick was like running around in a leotard for some reason. And the attractive woman who was played by Jean Triplehorn was also like running around dancing. At one point, I think they were like yelling at each other or arguing. And then they're spraying a hose and you hear like the jungle beats and stuff like that, but you also hear a chant. And then as you listen closely, the chant's going, Wilson, Wilson. You can hear it here. Then we see the gag. It's a commercial for Wilson garden hoses.
Wilson Garden Hose, available at the Home Shop.
My favorite movie trailer parody, by the way, my favorite commercial parody, by the way, on the Ben Stiller Show, Die Hard 12, Die Hungry. Stiller plays a perfect John McClane, and the concept is that he's going grocery shopping on Christmas Eve, and terrorists take over the supermarket. Janine Garofalo plays his wife. Bob Odenkirk plays the police captain, and Taylor Negron, who was in a number of different things you'd recognize and you saw them, played the head terrorist. Here's a little bit of the sketch.
It's Christmas Eve in L.A., and New York cop John McClane is shopping with his wife.
California.
Everyone on their floor must now. Attention, shopper. For the next 10 minutes, we will have a special offer. $2 million in Christmas coupons in exchange for your life. Das war Dania and ciao.
What country is this guy from?
They're as brilliant as they are ruthless.
I want the Christmas coupon.
Beat me.
Bon appetit, Mr. Whipple.
But he's very cunning.
Find him!
Paper or plastic, you son of a...
Other great sketches from The Ben Stiller Show include Bob Odenkirk as Charles Manson in a call-in advice show called Ask Manson. Stiller did his Springsteen impression a number of times. The most famous sketch, I think, or the best one, was called Legends of Springsteen. There was a Cops parody at the Salem Witch Trials, which is actually very, very funny. Stiller did impressions of people like Bono. He did Daniel Day-Lewis in his Last of the Mohicans character advertising the, I think it was like a treadmill called the Mohican Master 3000. He did this amazing Tony Robbins parody. I really recommend finding the show on like YouTube or elsewhere and watching what you can of it. It is a very, very funny show. Even the stuff that is dated because it was the 90s and they were referencing like contemporary things still works. And it's no wonder that all the members of that show went on to some sort of success. Now, finally, the last show I'm going to talk about is the sketch comedy show, and was the sketch comedy show for Fox, is In Living Color.
Like a balloon, you see, it's never too late and it's never too soon. Take it from me, it's I to be in living color. And now we're
Did you feel knowing prejudice was obsolete? And all mankind danced to the exact beat. And at night it was safe to walk down the street.
In living color.
Is yours or what's yours is mine.
In living color.
And how would you feel knowing everybody was your friend? From thin to thick and through thick and thin, and egotistical trips was put to an end.
In living color.
The moon float like a balloon. You see, it's never too late and it's never too soon. Take it from me, it's aight to be
in living color.
And how would you feel knowing prejudice was obsolete? And all mankind danced to the exact beat. And at night it was safe to walk down the street
in living color.
Running from the 1990 to the 1994 seasons, the show is produced by Keenan Ivory Wayans, who at this point was hot off the success of movies like I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, and starred a few of his family members, notable Damon, Kim, and Sean. Marlon would be on later. Sean, in the original season or two, was DJ SW1 before going on to become a cast member. Other cast members included David Alan Greer, Jamie Foxx, Tommy Davidson, and Jim Carrey, who was billed as James Carrey, by the way. The show is known for a number of sketches and characters. I'll get to those. It was also known for the Fly Girls. These were dancers who would perform during the interstitials and who were choreographed by Rosie Perez. She danced with them as well on a few episodes. And of course, the most famous of the Fly Girls was Jennifer Lopez. I watched the show for 3 out of its 5 seasons, maybe some of the 4th one as well. I know I really didn't watch the last season, though. In Living Color premiered in April of 1990, and for those first few seasons, it was appointment television in my junior high school. On Monday morning, it really was all anybody ever talked about. It is an iconic piece of popular culture. I cannot give it enough justice, too. I mean, I'm doing a short segment here, but I will list some of my favorite sketches. Jim Carrey as Vanilla Ice. You have to watch that. It is absolutely hilarious. Carrey did the Cherub of Justice character, as well as Fire Marshal Bill.
Let me show you something. Let's just say you're changing the water in this here fish tank, and you accidentally fill it with gasoline, like so. Later that night, the janitor comes in. There's a power outage. He lights himself a match, and oh, he's cooking fish.
Kim Wayans' character, Benita Betrell, who would tell you all about people and then say, but I wanted to gossip, so you ain't heard it from me.
Oh, look at that. There go Peabody Scott. Yeah, Peabody Scott from Building 92. So you got the whole brew with him tonight. Peabody! Peabody! Somebody ought to give you the Father of the Year award. Mm-hmm. We need more men like you in these projects. Always got them kids out with you. That little one over there got your personality.
His personality in the maintenance man's eyes. Damn fool ain't one of them kids is. That last one came out looking so much like the mailman people were sticking letters in his diapers. I ain't one to gossip, so you ain't heard that from me. No, you haven't.
And you had Damon Wayans, who really was one of the best actors on the, or comedians on the show. He would do the prisoner Oswald, who had the overuse of vocabulary, like really big vocabulary words, and thought everything was a conspiracy. Wayans was also Homie the Clown.
Yeah! All right, what y'all want me to do first?
Ooh. Oh! Homie, y'all do a silly clown dance for us. Oh. Yeah!
Degrade myself, huh? I don't think so. Homie, don't play that.
And of course, his most iconic character was one of a duo called Men on Film. It was a Siskel and Ebert parody where two gay men reviewed films and would give them instead of 2 thumbs up, 2 snaps up. It's problematic in part of its like the content from the day of how we view things now. It really would not probably not pass unless it was deemed as like camp in that sense, because it is very deliberately over the top. So, but I'm not going to let my opinion or judgment be the one that decides that. I would say that I think a number of people would consider it problematic these days, but still, it's very, very funny. I watched a couple of the sketches. It's still very funny. Men on Film is actually very important to In Living Color for a couple of reasons. And one of them is that the fact that Fox in 1992 ran a live episode of In Living Color specifically during the Super Bowl halftime show as counter programming. What they did was they aired the show while the halftime show was going on, and 20 million people flipped over to Fox and watched it. The biggest thing was Men on Football, which was incredibly suggestive, obviously. Unedited version, by the way, is available on YouTube. It actually is impressive about how raunchy they were able to get. It is one of the sketches they the most. 20 million people watched this, by the way, led to the following year where Michael Jackson did the Super Bowl halftime show. And from then on, it has been big name music celebrities. And In Living Color's counter programming was a big part of the NFL realizing what it needed to do. I'd say Men on Film, probably one of the sketches that people remember the most. I mean, to the point when Damon Wayans was on SNL in 1995, he and Chris Farley did a Men on Film sketch where Wayans was his character Blaine Edwards and Farley was Roger Ebert. And I believe David Alan Grier came in toward the end as Antoine Merriweather. That was pretty funny in itself. But again, it's funny to see sometimes old In Living Color characters would pop up on other sketch shows that the people who were playing them were known for. You know, so the show, it's not just famous for who was on it, because it was a launching pad for Carey, Wayans, Fox, others. It was legitimately a hit. I mean, it was giving Saturday Night Live a run for its money. It won the Emmy for Outstanding Variety Music or Comedy Series in 1990. And I also want to say that it was maybe the first successful sketch comedy to be run by and starring a majority black cast that went right for humor for a black audience. It was, at the time, the most successful sketch show that Fox ran. That would probably be surpassed by Mad TV, because Mad TV ran for 14 seasons starting in 1996, directly opposite Saturday Night Live. But, I don't know, to me, In Living Color is the better show, and it's probably the more memorable or more iconic, at least to my generation. Your mileage may vary, but I'm going to stand by that. By the way, there's a number of In Living Color episodes and sketches on YouTube. Check those out. Check out the Jim Carrey Vanilla Ice thing. Check out the Men on Film stuff, Homie the Clown, Fire Marshal Bill, a number of other ones that were very, very funny. They really do hold up in a big way. And like I said, the second era of Fox ends in the fall of 1994 when their NFL coverage begins. At that point, a number of these shows remained, while some had come and gone or were very much on their way out. As the 90s went on, Fox would still keep its eye on younger audiences and on genre television, but I would say it lost some of that Wild West sense along with some of the edge it had in those early years. Sure, you'd get some riskier, controversial stuff, especially in reality television, but it was more of its first, like, we're a regular network now era. This season, because I looked up, like, what was on this season on Fox, it's kind of sad, honestly. They have their Long in the Tooth Sunday animation block, although they ended up preempting that for 3 weeks back in March for a miniseries called The Faithful Women of the Bible. That miniseries seems to have gotten very mixed reviews and very poor ratings. Fox airs a number of reality TV shows and game shows. Dramas are crime shows and medical shows that would probably be welcome on any other network. And I think, in fact, the Series 911, which I think is on ABC now, originated on Fox. They do air sports. I mean, college football, college basketball, I think, definitely still football. They had Major League Baseball for a little while. But for a network that was known for being different, and even at the forefront of youth culture, at least as far as a broadcast network could be, I look at Fox's schedule and I shrug just as much as I shrug at NBC, CBS, or ABC. But that first Fox decade, clearly something to be nostalgic about. So before I go, I have some feedback. It's on my recent Donna Troy episode. Over on Blue Sky, Michael Wagner commented and said, "Great episode. Just your description of that section with Donna's parents and Robert got to me." I appreciate that. I had so much fun putting that episode together, and that scene really hit me too. On Facebook, Clinton Robeson said, "A Donna Troy origin story, not the Donna Troy origin story." David Ace Gutierrez commented, "Should it be, why is Donna Troy?" So thank you guys. I love making that episode. It's a great comic story. It gave me some of my favorite characters reflecting on one of their best eras by a creator I've been following for 30 years. I mean, Phil Jimenez is right now at the top of my comic signing bucket list. One day he will be at a convention that I'm going to, and I will bring a pile of shit for him to sign. But who knows when that will be. For now, I'm going to close out this episode, and I'm going to tell you what the next episode will be, because that does it for Fox. Sort of. Because in that rundown of Fox shows from 1986 to 1984, there is one glaring omission. One that maybe a few people who are listening to this are probably screaming at me to mention, and one of those people is probably Michael Bailey, because I wanted it to get its own episode. So come back next time as I dive into Parker Lewis Can't Lose. Until then, check out the show notes and the blog for more posts. And I have another Instagram if you're interested in following my writing. It's at Tom Panarese Writes. Feel free to check that out. I try to post every day at least one picture. I'm trying to get better at the social media thing for these things. But until then, thank you very much for listening, and take care. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Affidavit, which is hosted and produced by me, Tom Panarese. The theme music is Pop Rock by Scott Holmes and is used under Creative Commons licensing. You can contact and follow me via email at popcultureaffidavit@gmail.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Pop Culture Affidavit, and on Blue Sky as Pop Aff. That's PopAff. And of course, you can find episode links, show notes, and blog posts on my website, popcultureaffidavit.com. Thanks very much for listening, and come back next time for more pop culture randomness.